Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We'll also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Before we get started, I ended up not releasing this last week because the research took a massive detour. However, I am releasing the complete topic today in two episodes. So make sure you stick around at the end for the next one so you don't miss out on the second half of this topic. Today we are diving into the science of abductions, looking at them both as a direct precursor to homicide and as a standalone crime of absolute control. When we analyze these cases, a crucial question emerges. Why do we treat abduction as its own distinct behavioral category when the underlying mechanics look so terrifyingly similar to murder? Fight like hell at the car door. If you have ever taken a self-defense class, read a personal safety guide, or sat through a standard law enforcement brief, you've heard that rule. You do not get in the vehicle. You do not let them push you into the trunk. You make your stand right there on the asphalt, under the streetlights, because the second an offender forces you across the threshold to a secondary location, your statistical odds of survival collapse. It is a proven vital rule of street safety. But when we step back and look at it through the lens of forensic science and spatial analysis, the mechanics of crossing the threshold reveal a much deeper story. To the offender, the second location feels like a tactical shield. They believe that by removing a victim from the chaotic public point of initial contact, they're stepping off the radar, buying time, and taking total control. They're wrong. In forensic reality, a second location is not a shield. It is an operational trap. The moment that threshold is crossed, the offender begins broadcasting physical, spatial, and behavioral evidence directly into the forensic record. When we evaluate the car door through a spatial lens, we're looking at a critical inflection point in the physics of the crime scene. Up until the moment of forced transit, the offender is operating in an open, unpredictable environment. The street, the parking lot, or the driveway represents an infinite number of variables. Witnesses, passing vehicles, ambient light, security cameras, and immediate physical interference. The offender's primary focus at that initial contact point is speed and risk suppression. The moment the victim is forced across the threshold of a vehicle frame or a trunk, the spatial dynamics invert completely. The vehicle acts as a temporary pressure vessel. Inside that enclosed mobile space, the offender achieves instant artificial environmental control. Ambient noise is dampened, line of sight from the outside is restricted, and the victim's physical movement is mechanically constrained by the architecture of the cabin or cargo space. But here's the thermodynamic catch that offenders routinely fail to calculate. While a vehicle limits the victim's physical escape, it exponentially increases the rate of mutual trace transfer. In forensic physics, Edmond Locard's exchange principle states that whenever two objects come into contact, there is an inevitable transfer of material. In an open environment, those transfers are diluted by ambient air movement, ground dirt, and weather. But inside the confined, highly pressurized cabin of an automobile, that exchange is accelerated. High friction textile contacts between clothes and upholstery shear off microscopic fibers. Rapid stressed breathing and physical struggle disperse skin squamies, biological aerosols, and shed hairs into the closed air currents. By forcing a victim into a vehicle to escape the risk of the street, the offender unwittingly seals themselves into a microenvironment with their victim. The car door isn't just the line between freedom and captivity. It's the exact boundary where a low-yield street contact turns into a high-density trace evidence incubator, and the clock is ticking for both of them. At its core, abduction is not merely a property crime or a movement of a body from point A to point B. Abduction is the deliberate, violent theft of human autonomy. It's the act of stripping away a person's agency and reducing them entirely to an object. A subject existing purely to serve the offender's internal desires. Whether the victim ultimately survives or dies in that second location is often a matter of the offender's specific operational plan, or in many cases, a failure of their logistics. But the fundamental pathology remains the same. The murderer destroys consciousness permanently to achieve absolute control, while the long-term captor attempts something far more complex. They try to erase the victim's agency while keeping the biological machine running. This is precisely why abduction serves as a critical forensic indicator. The act itself tells us immediately that the perpetrator is crossing an operational boundary. They are moving from an opportunistic crime of impulse to a crime that requires logistics, spatial management, and physical containment. Understanding this distinction is vital for an investigation. If law enforcement misreads an isolationist captor as a standard serial killer, they may search remote roads for a body while the perpetrator sits comfortably in a neighborhood home, running a hidden operational hub under everyone's nose. Conversely, if investigators treat a rapid transient killer like an isolationist, they waste precious hours waiting for contact while crucial physical evidence degrades in the field. When survivors escape these environments, they offer us something unique. They give us a direct window into the offender's mind, revealing how these perpetrators attempt to solve the physics of human containment and where their operational discipline inevitably breaks down. This brings us to our central thesis of how the long-term captor trades tactical insulation of a secondary site for a forensic death trap for them. Boogeyman aside, the isolationist kidnapper is not merely a monster operating in the dark. Behaviorally and psychologically, they are an unstable dictator trying to build a microstate. While the captor believes that physical isolation and heavy deadbolts grant them total insulation from the law, basic thermodynamics, developmental biology, and microbial transmission prove that a parallel world is simply too heavy to maintain or to hide. To understand why these environments collapse under their own weight, we have to look at the tactical inversion between standard homicide and long-term isolation. It boils down to a fundamental choice in the logistics of motive, disposal versus ownership. In a standard homicide or serial abduction, the second location serves as a transient logistical step. Its sole purpose is an unmonitored exit strategy where the killer controls variables just long enough to ensure the violent act or the disposal of the body occurs without witnesses. In this scenario, the second location is just a disposable container, like the garbage bin of the crime. The killer's ultimate operational goal is total detachment. They want to dump the remains, sanitize what they can on the fly, step away, and completely delink themselves from that geographic coordinate forever. In an isolation kidnapping, the logic is entirely inverted. The second location is not a transient stop on a map, it's a permanent operational hub, the absolute epicenter of the perpetrator's daily life. The motive's not rapid disposal, but absolute long-term ownership, containment, and the meticulous calibration of another human being's physical, sensory, and biological existence. In isolation kidnapping, the location is the crime. The perpetrator cannot de-link from the site because they are functionally tethered to it by the continuous physical demands of their captive. They cannot walk away, they cannot abandon the grid, and they cannot stop managing the space without risking immediate system failure. While the captor believes that heavy deadbolts grant them total insulation, basic thermodynamics and biology prove that a parallel world is simply too heavy to hide. Human existence is fundamentally entropic. A parallel world, whether a fortified bedroom, a damp basement pit, or an underground bunker, cannot remain closed to the universe. A human body requires continuous inputs, oxygen, caloric intake, thermal regulation, and clean water. That same body generates continuous outputs, metabolic waste, shed epidermal cells, carbon dioxide, and volatile organic compounds. Every input brought across the perimeter and every biological output created by it functions as a direct, unerasable forensic leak. In their desperate bid to construct an off-the-grid domain of absolute omnipotence, the isolationist kidnapper does not build a sanctuary. They build a physical prison for themselves, effectively handcuffing their own daily life to their most damaging physical evidence. To deconstruct that core survival axiom that we discussed, never let them take you to a second location, under a clinical perspective, we classify the resultant physical space into two distinct criminal, spatial, and thermodynamic realities. The first classification is the transient execution site. In this model, the abduction itself functions as a transient variable, a rapid, ruthless logistical maneuver executed solely to clear the high-risk point of initial contact. Behaviorally, the physical space is completely unengineered. The perpetrator relies entirely on existing remote natural geography, a dark canyon, a deserted stretch of coastline, an isolated forest service road, to act as a temporary environmental cloaking device. They do not invest time, energy, or construction materials into securing the location. The offender operates under a single assumption that the victim will die rapidly, and that natural degradation, weather, and wild animal activity will wipe the forensic slate clean before a search grid is established. Because the offender expects the environment to consume the evidence, they view the location as a single-use container. They dump the subject, commit the violence, and flee, counting on simple geographical distance to isolate them from the act. The fundamental flaw in this strategy lies in the perpetrator's calculation of the biological timeline. Offenders assume the human organism will succumb to catastrophic physical trauma and exposure on a fast, predictable schedule. But when a victim exhibits extraordinary, profound biological defiance and survives that initial trauma, the entire thermodynamic equation inverts. The perpetrator believes they've left a cold, degrading body in an unmonitored wilderness. Instead, the victim's sheer refusal to die converts that empty natural space into an immediate, trace-rich, active crime scene. To understand why a transient execution site surrenders its evidence so rapidly, we have to look at how nature interacts with a biological disruption. Offenders choose remote outdoor locations under the naive assumption that the wilderness is an empty, silent void that destroys evidence. But to a forensic scientist, an outdoor dump site is an active, highly sensitive biological system that instantly registers foreign interference. The moment an offender steps off a paved shoulder and onto an unengineered surface, they initiate three distinct forensic times. First is the geological and botanical clock. Unconsolidated soil, leaf litter, and mud are non-Newtonian materials. When a foot or vehicle tire compresses wet earth, it breaks the soil structure and crushes localized plant cells. The plant releases volatile organic compounds, stress chemicals, while the broken soil exposes fresh, moist subsurface layers to oxygen, triggering rapid oxidation. Furthermore, the specific mineralogical composition of that soil, its ratio of clay, sand, silt, organic matter, acts as a geographic fingerprint. When an offender steps back onto the pavement, those microparticles remain wedged in the sipes of their shoe soles or tire treads, waiting to be matched under a polarized light microscope. And second is the entomological clock. The human body begins emitting trace volatile chemicals, primarily putrescine and cadaverine, within minutes of death, often long before human olfaction can detect it. Blowflies can detect these chemical plumes from miles away, arriving at a transient site within minutes. When they lay their eggs, they start an unyielding biological stopwatch. By measuring the ambient temperature of the microclimate and calculating the accumulated degree hours required for larvae to progress through specific instar stages, forensic entomologists can calculate the time of colonization down to a narrow window, completely dismantling a fabricated alibi. And third is the thermodynamic degradation of fluid dynamics. When arterial bleeding occurs in an open landscape, blood does not simply disappear into the dirt. As blood impacts soil or foliage, its viscosity, surface tension, and velocity create distinct spatter patterns. Droplets striking broad leaves create secondary satellite spatter that indicates the direction and energy of the impact. As the liquid component of blood drains into porous soil, it leaves behind a concentrated crust of dried fibrin and cellular debris that binds to microparticles of earth, preserving localized biological evidence for weeks, even after a heavy rainfall. The offender views the forest as, or the desert, or as a giant eraser. The laboratory views it as a hypersensitive recording medium. History shows us that the gamble isn't always in the perpetrator's favor. We see this most closely in cases where an intended murder victim escapes the fate assumed for them and survives the initial assault in the secondary location. In September of 1978, 15-year-old Mary Vincent was hitchhiking near Modesto, California, when she was picked up by 50-year-old Lawrence Singleton. Singleton drove her away from the public eye and deep into a remote canyon, his chosen transient location. There, the atmosphere shifted instantly to pure violence. Singleton struck her across the head with a sledgehammer, crushingly rendering her unconscious. After subjecting her to a horrific, prolonged sexual assault, Singleton took a hatchet and systematically hacked off both of her forearms at the elbow. To ensure she would never leave the canyon alive, he dragged her naked, mutilated body to the edge of a steep embankment and threw her down a 30-foot concrete culvert beside Interstate 5, leaving her to bleed out in the dark. Singleton relied on the isolation of the unlit canyon, the 30-foot vertical drop, and the violent mechanics of radial and ulnar arterial spurting to do his work for him. He assumed the biological clock of catastrophic insanguination would run out in minutes. Mary Vincent defied that biological clock through raw, visceral instinct. Regaining consciousness at the bottom of the culvert, she realized her blood was rapidly pumping out onto the concrete. Lacking hands, she forced her severed, bone-exposed stumps directly into the dry dirt and mud at the base of the drainage pipe, grinding the soil into her open wounds to form a crude, coagulated plug that physically choked off the arterial bleeding. With her hemorrhage suppressed, she faced the 30-foot concrete slope. She couldn't grip, so she dug her raw elbows into the rough concrete, using her feet and the blunt ends of her arms to drag her weight upward inch by inch, leaving a thick smear of dirt and blood along the wall. Once at the top, naked, shock-ridden, and coated in dried mud, she forced her feet forward, walking nearly 4 miles along the gravel shoulder of the highway in the middle of the night until she flagged down a passing vehicle. Mary's survival completely shattered Singleton's operational assumptions. Because he treated that remote canyon as a disposable endpoint, he spent zero effort sanitizing the terrain or covering his tracks. The moment Mary flagged down help, that isolated patch of dirt transformed into an immediate, high-priority crime scene. Forensic technicians recovered a pristine, unmanaged trail of physical evidence, deep tire tread impressions, localized footwear prints, heavy blood spatter on the brush, and matching soil transfer evidence from her arm wounds that linked directly back to the canyon floor and Singleton's vehicle, resulting in his rapid arrest. By refusing to die on the perpetrator's timeline, Mary Vincent converted a transient execution site into an inescapable forensic trap. 16 years later, in December of 1994, on the outskirts of Port Elizabeth, South Africa, we see this exact visceral defiance play in the case of 27-year-old Alison Botha. Alison was abducted at knife point outside her apartment by Franz Dutoit and Thijs Kruger. Her attackers drove her to a completely deserted coastal clearing on the edge of town, a classic transient site chosen purely for its complete absence of artificial lighting and total isolation. Once at the clearing, the assault escalated into sheer brutality. Her attackers attempted to suffocate her into unconsciousness before taking a knife to her midsection, stabbing her 36 times in the abdomen until her abdominal wall collapsed and she was completely disemboweled. When they realized her body was still grasping for air, they systematically slit her throat 17 times, slicing deep into her neck muscles, nerves, and trachea until her head was severed from her spine, held to her torso only by a thin fraction of tissue. Believing no human organism could survive that level of catastrophic anatomical destruction, her attackers abandoned her body in the dirt and drove away. Alison Botha refused to let her motor functions shut down. Regaining a sliver of consciousness in the dark, she felt the cool night air hitting her exposed internal organs. Operating purely on survival physics, she took her denim shirt and physically shoved her spilling intestines back inside her torn abdominal cavity, bundling the fabric tight against her stomach. Then, realizing her head was flopping backward and cutting off her airway, she reached up with one hand to physically grab her own hair, holding her head upright against her neck to manually stabilize her sliced trachea so oxygen could reach her lungs. In that state, holding her own body together with her bare hands, she dragged herself through the dirt, sharp thorns, broken glass of the clearing, crawling inch by inch toward the faint glow of distant headlights until she reached the main road. Just like Lawrence Singleton, Botha's attackers operated under the arrogant assumption that the unengineered geography was act as a permanent silent vault for a corpse. But the moment Allison reached that road, her survival handed the exact grid coordinates directly to law enforcement. Because her attackers had fled immediately, confident that nature would consume her remains, they left behind a gold mine of unmanaged physical evidence. Tire impressions, violent struggle marks, discarded personal items, and biological fluid transfers that led police straight to their front door. To understand how a transient execution site functions when an abduction ends in homicide rather than immediate survival, We looked to San Diego County, California, in February 2002. 7-year-old Danielle Van Dam was abducted from her second-story bedroom in the suburban neighborhood of Sabre Springs. Her abductor, 49-year-old self-employed engineer David Westerfield, lived just 2 doors down. Westerfield did not construct a static prison to hold Danielle. Instead, he relied on mobility and natural geography, utilizing his 35-foot luxury motorhome as a mobile secondary location and transit container to move her to a remote desert clearing off of DeHaese Road. Westerfield operated under a classic offender delusion. He believed that by putting miles of asphalt between his permanent residence, his vehicle, and a brush-covered embankment in the unincorporated backcountry, he had successfully severed the spatial grid. He calculated that the harsh desert sun, high ambient temperatures, and natural scavengers would rapidly consume the biological evidence, erasing any trace of his presence before an investigation could orient itself. He completely miscalculated the thermodynamic and forensic footprint of his own transit container. When a perpetrator uses a vehicle to facilitate an abduction, they operate under the false assumption that a mobile enclosure acts like a safety deposit box. In forensic reality, a motorhome is not a vault. It's a high-yield, closed-loop trace evidence trap. When law enforcement executed search warrants on Westerfield's vehicle, forensic criminalists did not find a sanitized space. They uncovered a rich biological and physical environment. The motorhome's interior carpets, upholstery, and bed linens yielded microscopic fibers matching the carpet in Danielle's bedroom. Technicians recovered hairs matching her DNA profile in the bathroom sink drain and found her blood on the carpet between the bathroom and the closet. Even more damning, latent print examiners recovered her handprint, along with several distinct fingerprints, on a cabinet door directly above the motorhome's bed. Panicked by the growing law enforcement presence in the neighborhood upon his return, Westerfield attempted a hasty, localized sanitation effort. Early on a freezing Monday morning, he arrived at a local dry cleaner wearing only a thin t-shirt, shorts, and no shoes or socks, dropping off a jacket, 2 comforters, and his bed sheets for same-day cleaning. To a forensic scientist, this behavior is a textbook panic response. Westerfield believed that commercial chemical solvents would wipe his slate clean. Instead, his desperate attempt to sanitize his bedding created an unerasable chain of custody. When technicians seized the dry cleaning under a search warrant, they discovered Danielle's blood directly from his jacket, along with fibers from her home and hairs from the Van Damme family dog embedded in his comforter. While the trace evidence inside the vehicle bound Westerfield to Danielle, it was the physical geography of the dump site that bound his vehicle to the murder scene. Sand, soil, and specific botanical fragments scraped from the undercarriage and the wheel wells of his motorhome yielded a precise mineralogical profile that matched the earth at the Dehesa Road location. When searchers discovered Danielle's body 3 weeks later, Westerfield's reliance on nature to consume his crime completely backfired. Because her remains were severely decomposed, traditional pathology could not establish a definitive cause of death or perform standard toxicology. The crime scene surrendered its timeline through a different scientific discipline, forensic entomology. Forensic entomologists analyzed the development cycles of blowfly larvae recovered from her remains. By calculating regional meteorological data and ambient temperature fluctuations against the specific life stages of insect colonization, scientists established a precise biological timeline of exposure. That biological clock completely demolished Westerfield's defense alibi, proving that her body was deposited in the brush during the exact window Westerfield claimed to be somewhere else in his motorhome. David Westerfield attempted a transient sprint. He relied on a mobile container and an unengineered outdoor dump site to hide a murder, expecting geography and time to erase his crime. Instead, his operational choices created an inescapable web of physical evidence. The sand on his tires, the blood on his dry clean jacket, the fingerprints on his cabinetry, and the insect life cycles in the soil tied his home, his vehicle, and the desert clearing into a single, unyielding forensic blueprint. Then you have the weird hybrids, like Ted Bundy, who start off as someone who uses the second location as an initial dumping site, but ends up revisiting the scene, turning the secondary location into a sort of abduction holding site, where the victims are no longer alive, but a site they keep revisiting and depositing evidence. Bundy started with a standard transient execution strategy, using unengineered remote timberlands like Taylor Mountain or Issaquah to abandon victims and clear the high-risk contact zone. However, his severe necrophilic fixation forced a dangerous tactical regression. Rather than walking away and letting nature erase his footprint, he repeatedly returned to those isolated coordinates over days and weeks to groom, paint, and interact with the remains. In doing so, Bundy attempted to force an open, unengineered wilderness to function as a private static sanctuary. From a forensic standpoint, every single return trip was an act of operational self-sabotage. By repeatedly walking those same forest paths, he left fresh footwear tread impressions, deposited new fiber and biological evidence, and created a predictable geographical anchor. His psychological obsession demanded long-term control, but physics ensured that each return visit bound him tighter to the crime scene, proving that even a meticulously calculated transient strategy will inevitably collapse when fantasy overrides survival instinct. The transient execution site is usually just a violent sprint, a desperate, unengineered scramble to use speed and geography to outrun the law. But as we've seen through the physics of mobile transit, the mechanics of trace evidence and the incredible biological defiance of survivors like Mary Vincent and Allison Botha, relying on a transient drop is a massive gamble for an offender. They leave behind a chaotic, unmanaged trail of soil transfers, fiber exchanges, and biological clocks that hand the grid coordinates right back to the laboratory. Even when you look at hybrid offenders like Ted Bundy, who tried to turn these open-air dump sites into private, repeatable sanctuaries, the strategy fails. Every single time he walked back into those forest paths to reestablish control, His compulsion forced him to leave fresh footwear impressions and biological evidence, turning what he thought was a hidden domain into a high density and evidence trap. And that brings us to the ultimate failure point of the transient site. Because these perpetrators abandoned the scene under the arrogant assumption that death is immediate and inevitable, they leave the environment completely unmanaged. The moment a victim defies that timeline and survives, or the second forensic science decodes the soil and insect activity left behind, that empty clearing stops hiding the killer and starts building the case against them. So, what happens when an offender realizes the fatal flaw of the transient sprint? What happens when they accept that outdoor geography is way too wild, unpredictable, and exposed to guarantee total control? They abandon the sprint entirely. They try to build a permanent engineered prison under everyone's nose, pulling the crime out of the woods and into the walls of standard society, trading a disposable dump site for brick and mortar fortress. That brings us straight into the opposite end of our spatial taxonomy, the microenvironmental prison. In part two, we step across that threshold and into the off-the-grid universe, where we unpack the engineering, the life support logistics, and the inevitable catastrophic failure of captors like Ariel Castro, Gary Heidnik, and Joseph Fritzl. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me. If you found today's deep dive into environmental trace evidence fascinating, please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community. I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come learn along with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I'll see you in the next episode.